We're reading from verse 28. Now when the Lord spoke to Moses in Egypt, he said to him, I am the Lord, tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, everything I tell you. But Moses said to the Lord, since I speak with faltering lips, why would Pharaoh listen to me? Then the Lord said to Moses, see, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of his country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. Moses was 80 years old and Aaron 83 when they spoke to Pharaoh. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when Pharaoh says to you, perform a miracle, then say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned the wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same thing by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said.
Do sit down. When I'm working out on my exercise bike and pushing myself really, really hard, I like to watch something, mainly to take away the pain because, you know, I go through the barrier regularly. But I love watching something on the telly or on my computer. I've managed to watch all 7 series of The West Wing whilst being sat on my exercise bike, watching Josiah Bartlett and his staff govern in America. So now I've had to find something else to start watching. So I started plowing through another box set that I got given for Father's Day last year, I think it was. Sylvester Stallone is Rocky. You may mock, I hear you giggling. Now don't forget, and some of you may not know this, Rocky, the first one, won the Best Picture Oscar at the 1976 Academy Awards. Now, for the uneducated, and some may even argue uncultured among you, the story is of a man called Rocky Balboa. He's an unknown journeyman boxer who's given an opportunity to fight for the heavyweight title of the world against the fabulously named Apollo Creed. And the film also includes a wonderful love story as Rocky gently pursues Adrienne, that shy, quiet girl who works in the local pet shop. So guys, get Rocky out this Friday evening, cuddle up with your wife. She'll be really grateful for an opportunity to watch this wonderful love story. I won't tell you what happens at the end, but the film, the story, is a story of opposites. It's the greatest in the world taking on the unknown. The unheralded journeyman, the brash, loud, confident Apollo Creed, with all his resources, all his wealth, with a backup team that you can't count, taking on the penniless, managerless fighter, who'd even had his locker taken away from him in his gym because the owner thought he had no future. And that just reminded me this bit this morning of the place we've got to in the story of Exodus. We've now got a reluctant Moses, a man in his 80s, arrogant Pharaoh, considered by his people as a god. We've got a non-nation against the greatest of nations, a nation of slaves against their masters. This is as one-sided as it gets. Forget Rocky versus Apollo. There can only be one winner in this contest. Or so you'd think. Because there's one factor that we haven't brought into this yet. And it's not that Hollywood style artistic license that means the little guy always wins. And I'm still not giving away the end of Rocky for anyone who hasn't watched it. So let's get into this. Let's have a look to see what is that missing factor. Let's see what happens in Egypt versus Israel and Moses versus Pharaoh. So please do grab a Bible. They're not going to be on the screen behind me, so do grab a Bible there. And we're looking on page 63 in the passage that Lara read to us a bit earlier. Now, last week, for those of you who were here, Simon took us through the family line of Aaron and Moses, seen there in verses 13 to 27. Now, those verses are a bit of a departure from the narrative. It's sort of a bracketed section designed to lay down the genealogical line of Moses and Aaron. So, to find out where we are today, we need to go back a little bit further and look at the verses immediately preceding those. Those of you here a fortnight ago, and remember, as we left the narrative, God was commanding Moses to go and tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites leave Egypt. And it's safe to say Moses wasn't particularly keen to do so. You remember how Jace helpfully took us through how Moses had repeatedly come back at God, reminding him of all the reasons why he wasn't the man to be God's mouthpiece. He wasn't the man that God should send. And don't forget, things have got a whole lot worse for the Israelites on the one occasion Moses had gone to Pharaoh. There were so many reasons to send someone else. But that's not how God works, and that wasn't how God worked here. Moses was his chosen man, and here in verse 28, we revisit that conversation between Moses and God that had previously been recorded in chapter 6, verses 10 and 11. Verse 28. Now, when the Lord spoke to Moses in Egypt, he said to him, "I am the Lord. Tell Pharaoh, king of Egypt, everything I tell you." But Moses said to the Lord, "Since I speak with faltering lips, why would Pharaoh listen to me?" God reminds Moses who he is. "I am the Lord," and in whose authority he will be speaking. "I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, the God who rescued your people when famine threatened them, the God who brought them into Egypt, the God who met you in a burning bush. This is who is sending you. So go, tell the king of Egypt everything I tell you." Moses again doubted whether God had got this right. "Really? Me? Why on earth would Pharaoh listen to me? An old man who speaks poorly. At the very best, he's going to laugh me out of the room. At the very worst, I dread to think." But God isn't interested in Moses' grumbling. And he doesn't even really answer Moses' question or objection. He doesn't seek to reassure Moses about Moses. Instead, he talks about what he is going to do. This story isn't about Moses and Pharaoh. This story is about God fulfilling his will on earth. In this movie, God is the lead character. And as we look through these verses, we'll see three things. We'll see a sovereign God, we'll see an obedient Moses, and we'll see a powerful Savior. So first, a sovereign God. Verses 1 to 5. Look at those with me. "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'See, I have made you like God to Pharaoh, and your brother Aaron will be your prophet. You are to say everything I command you, and your brother Aaron is to tell Pharaoh to let the Israelites go out of this country. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to me, to you. Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it." Can you see here how God is the main character? Verse 1, "I have made you like God to Pharaoh." Verse 3, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. I will multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt. Verse 4, I will lay my hand on Egypt. Judgment, I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites. God is in control of the whole situation. This isn't a plan for Moses that is dependent on how Pharaoh is going to respond. In the coming weeks, we're going to be remembering the 70th anniversary of the D-Day landings, a turning point in the Second World War. And those plans were incredibly detailed and incredibly thought through. But I'm sure there were plans B, C, D, and E ready for implementation once they knew how the German armies responded. That's not what this is about. This is a foregone conclusion. This is going to happen. This is the God of the universe knowing exactly what is going to pan out in the coming weeks and months, because he is sovereign and has ordained all these things. He's saying to Moses, Moses, don't worry about who you are or how ill-equipped you think you are, because as far as Pharaoh is concerned, he's going to see you as his equal. You see, Pharaoh was considered a deity, as Jace has already mentioned. He wasn't just a leader of the nation. They looked at him as a god. And in verse 1, God says, I have made you like God to Pharaoh. And the original language here, interestingly, is even stronger than the NIV translation here. The simile word like isn't actually there. The actual language says, I have made you a god to Pharaoh. You may not be able to speak well, Moses is saying. You may think you're not the right man, but you're going to be operating with divine authority because I am the one who has sent you. And just like any decent deity of his day, he was going to operate through the words of a prophet. Step forward, big brother Aaron. His role was to present Moses' word without any alteration. He was going to be the organ of that message, the one that delivered it. Of course, Moses wasn't a god. And so his job was to declare and only declare what the true living God says. Because as we've already seen, he is the one that's directing this whole thing. So we can see God's sovereign there in how Moses should behave. But what about Pharaoh? What do we see there? Look at verse 3. But I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. We love the Bible here at Village Church. We believe in its inerrancy, that it's got no errors in it. We believe in its infallibility, that it's completely true and incapable of error. But that doesn't mean that there aren't things in here that we don't struggle with and find hard. And this is one of those verses. If God is sovereign over all things, if he's in control and knows all things and what's going to happen, then surely verse 3 should read something like this. I will soften Pharaoh's heart, and he will send you on your way with all the supplies you need, and will provide a military escort to protect you from those pesky nations living in the land that I have promised you. Isn't that what it should say? That God will just make life easy and get it all sorted? But it doesn't. It says, but I will harden Pharaoh's heart. And though I multiply my signs and wonders in Egypt, he will not listen to you. So what does this mean? Does it mean that God has made Pharaoh evil? Absolutely not. Pharaoh was evil in and of himself, just as the Bible teaches us that we all are. We all have hearts that are inclined towards evil. What it does mean is that God is giving Pharaoh over to his sinful ways. He chooses to refuse God, so God will allow him to continue to refuse him. Romans 1 explains this to us. We haven't got time to get into it, but do have a look at that later. Grab a commentary that might help you look through that. This isn't an easy thing to grasp. It's two sides of the same coin that is very difficult to understand. And we will be exploring this hardening of Pharaoh's heart over and over again in the coming weeks as we explore the plagues which God brought about as a result of Pharaoh's stubbornness. And the amazing thing here as well, we see it won't just be the words that Pharaoh refuses to respond to, because God is going to multiply his signs and wonders in Egypt. These are a direct reference to the plagues that are about to hit them. Even the frogs and the gnats and the locusts, even darkness at the height of day will not be enough for Pharaoh to acknowledge the one true God. God is sovereign even in Pharaoh's rejection of him. We can see here that God doesn't always do what we'd expect him to do. We often think that he will always do nice things for everyone and do them straight away. But that's not the case. Romans, again, tells us that God will have mercy on whom he desires and he hardens whom he desires. To expect God to do things how we want him to do them or how we would do them is actually to have a small view of who God is. God is just and holy. He's powerful and sovereign. He's compassionate and gracious. And he's all of these things perfectly. And it's only when we see God not just as these things, but also how big he is in his holiness and his power and his sovereignty, in his compassion and his grace, will we really start to grasp the wonderful truth of his sovereign will over this world and over our own lives. You see, the plagues themselves, even the plagues, whilst they were obvious acts of judgment, they too were acts of compassion and grace. These were another chance for the Egyptians to acknowledge who God is. And that's his ultimate aim. That is the purpose of his sovereign will, for his own creation to acknowledge who he is. Look at verse 5. And the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I stretch out my hand against Egypt and bring the Israelites out of it. One way or another, the Egyptians, including Pharaoh, will know that I am the Lord, that I am Yahweh, the one and only true God. Even Pharaoh will eventually see who he's dealing with. God will achieve his will. One day, one way or another, Pharaoh will bow down before him. Okay, so we've seen the sovereign God. And next we're going to see obedient Moses. Obedient Moses. Verse 6. Moses and Aaron did just as the Lord commanded them. What a great short sentence that is. Do you remember, that's a direct contrast to the Moses we saw a fortnight ago. The Moses who argued and disputed and questioned, I'm not the right man, don't send me, send somewhere else. Pharaoh's not going to listen to me. Now we see Moses and Aaron doing just as the Lord commanded. Moses now sees his role in this drama, his position, his place. He acknowledges God's sovereignty. He sees that God is in control. He understands what God is going to do, and therefore it doesn't matter if he's old or a nobody or can't speak well, because what he is doing, what the sovereign God has commanded him, is God's will, and it will come about. And in the bigger picture of Moses' life, it's interesting to note that from this point forward, in direct contrast to the man we've been looking at over the previous chapters, Moses continues to do exactly what God has commanded him to do, with only one exception: the time he struck the rock, which sadly meant that he was barred from entering the promised land. But we see a life of obedience See, once Moses understood the big picture, whose side he was on, obedience was the obvious course. He didn't fear man, even a man like Pharaoh, because he was on God's side. He was no longer concerned about how well he could speak, because the ears and the hearts of the people he was speaking to were controlled by God. He even didn't question God or what the point was going if Pharaoh's not even going to listen. Why bother going? Pharaoh's response was not Moses' concern. His role in this drama was simply to be obedient. So, obedient Moses and Aaron. Understanding God's sovereignty in the situation, make their way to the palace with a simple message from God. Let my people go. And in the confrontation that's about to take place, we finally see the powerful God. The powerful God. Before Moses and Aaron get to the palace, God just gives them one final set of instructions. Verse 8. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron, when Pharaoh says to you, perform a miracle, then say to Aaron, take your staff and throw it down before Pharaoh, and it will become a snake. I have to say, I've been encouraged by some of the guys at Eastern to try and make this a practical sermon and see if I can borrow someone's snake. But I've seen how some people here react when snakes are around, so I've decided not to do that this time. But Pharaoh was likely to ask Moses for some sort of sign to prove his credentials. And we're not just talking about some diplomatic papers or a certificate showing his PhD from the University of Cairo. No, Pharaoh wanted a miracle. He wanted a sign. He wanted to show that the person he was dealing with was someone worthy to be before him. And God had a miracle planned. A miracle that wouldn't just prove Moses' credentials, but would strike at the very heart of who Pharaoh was believed to be, and would prove who the one and only true God is. When he asks, God said, get Aaron to throw down his stick on the floor, and it'll turn into a snake. So into the palace they go, with a simple request and a stick. Verse 10. So Moses and Aaron went to Pharaoh, and did just as the Lord commanded. Aaron threw his staff down in front of Pharaoh and his officials, and it became a snake. Pharaoh then summoned wise men and sorcerers, and the Egyptian magicians also did the same things by their secret arts. Each one threw down his staff, and it became a snake. But Aaron's staff swallowed up their staffs. As expected, Pharaoh demanded this sign. And then we see one of the most bizarre events of the whole of the Bible take place. As commanded, Aaron threw down his staff, and bang, there's a snake. Now, there's some debate over what the word snake actually means in this passage. Some have even suggested that this is a bit more than a snake, almost like a dragon-like creature. But this was definitely not a grass snake. This was something ferocious, something very scary. This was a formidable creature. And it's now slithering around Pharaoh's palace. And there is a real significance that it was a snake that God chose. Because by choosing a snake, Pharaoh and the Egyptians are being attacked at the very heart of their beliefs. Depicted on the front of Pharaoh's crown is an enraged female cobra. Now, I've been told it should be cobra, but I've always said cobra, so I'm going to keep saying cobra. An enraged female cobra. This was considered to be a sign of Pharaoh's divine sovereignty and potency. It was an emblem of his power. It symbolized his divinity and his majesty. Aaron's miraculous act is a direct assault on the token of Pharaoh's sovereignty. So Pharaoh's response was to get his own guys in, to call his own men. His wise men, his magicians, and his sorcerers. Come on, boys. Don't let this upstart steal the show. Show them what you've got. So they too threw their staffs on the floor. And they too became snakes. I don't think Pharaoh only had half a dozen of these guys. I think there were lots of them. Pharaoh's palace is now teeming with snakes. Picture that scene in Indiana Jones. Well, that is what we're at now. A floor full of snakes. And you can imagine the smug look on Pharaoh's face as Aaron's solitary snake is outnumbered and maybe even surrounded by what his boys have come up with. There you go, boys. What do you say about that? Is that all you got? One poxy snake? That smug smile was quickly wiped off his face as Aaron's one poxy snake proceeded to, one by one, swallow all of the Egyptian snakes. An incredible scene. Something you'd love to be able to watch. But before we think about what this event meant in its place and in the bigger picture of the Exodus story, I think we do have to deal with one obvious question, because I'm sure a number of us are asking that question. We understand how a miracle-performing God could turn a staff into a snake. But how can these Egyptian magicians and sorcerers, how did they do that? Egypt was a place obsessed with occultic activity. Supernatural activity is not unusual in such places. In Western society, we find all this stuff a little bit bizarre and incredulous. But if you go to many places, even in the world today, witchcraft and sorcery are very, very real things. They're not unusual in such places. So I guess our lesson for us is we must never assume that every miraculous act is of God. The devil is a powerful being. He's far more powerful than we often appreciate. So we must be discerning when we hear about miraculous things. We must consider where they're from. Okay, so let's get back into it and think about what this event is all about. Now, it immediately precedes in the narrative, it's immediately before the 10 plagues. And in many ways, it's a prologue or a pattern of what's about to come. There's a request for the Israelite people to be allowed to go, a hardening of Pharaoh's heart, and then a miraculous act of judgment as proof of who the true God was. This was almost Moses and Aaron saying to Pharaoh, look, this is who you're dealing with. This is what will happen if you continue to be stubborn. And each of the plagues strikes at a specific Egyptian deity. And again, this prologue is no different. The snake of these men coming in the name of Yahweh had swallowed up the snakes of Pharaoh's magician. The very symbol of Pharaoh's deity had been defeated. God was showing Pharaoh who was really in control. You see, this wasn't a battle between Moses and Pharaoh. This isn't even a battle between Aaron and the Egyptian magicians, or between Israel and Egypt. You see, the missing factor that we didn't bring into the picture at the beginning is the fact that this is not a one-sided contest in the favor of Egypt, because the real battle is between God, the all-sovereign, all-powerful creator of the world, and the deities of Egypt. And the devil. So it's not surprising we see these supernatural events occurring, because ultimately this was a spiritual contest. This wasn't politics, this was a spiritual confrontation with God's salvation plan, the freeing of his people to the promised land, at the very center of it. But there was only ever going to be one victor in this fight. There was only ever going to be one person who would be hailed as champion, Yahweh, the creator God. So surely now Pharaoh will see that. Verse 13. Yet Pharaoh's heart became hard, and he would not listen to them, just as the Lord had said. Just as God had warned Moses, Pharaoh's heart became hard. And the signs and the wonders that God had promised, the plagues that would show Pharaoh the truth of the God of Israel, were now imminent. God's people would be free from the tyranny of slavery, but not just yet. God had business with Pharaoh and with Egypt to do first. And it's quite interesting just to understand how the writer's written this book, to see the next time we see something being swallowed up, Exodus 14, the Egyptian army is swallowed up by the Red Sea after the miraculous rescue of the Israelites. This passage and the Red Sea passage bookend this time of judgment towards the Egyptians and the freeing of the Israelites. So that's the story. There's some theological questions in there. There are some challenging things. But what can we learn from it? Firstly, live as if God is sovereign. Live as if God is sovereign. And I don't mean as if there in the sense that we're questioning it. As we've already said, God doesn't do things the way we think best. But God is sovereign in all and over all. We may have our plans. God usually has different ones. God is sovereign in great matters of state and in the minutiae of our lives. God knew what was going to go on in that palace with Pharaoh and Moses. And at the same time, he knew what was going on in the hearts of the humblest of the Israelite people in that time of slavery. His sovereign will was working in both of those situations. God's sovereignty is never contradicted in apparently opposite situations. His sovereignty intertwines everything that is going on so that his will is fulfilled. Now, I don't know what's going on in your lives at the moment. I know some of you are facing difficult times. Some of you are being challenged in different ways. But this passage teaches us that God is in each of those. God is sovereign in each of those. They are part of his will for your life and for his glory. Whether it's illness, fear about work, anxiety about relationships, God is in those things. He is sovereign. And we can react to God's sovereignty in one of two ways. We can respond with fear. What on earth is God going to do with my life? Or we can respond in confidence with, this God really knows what he's going to do with my life. And our response will depend on how high our view of God is. If we have a small view of God, we will doubt his plans and his ability to do what is right and good. Now, I don't think any of us here would ever actually say that. I don't think any of us will actually articulate such thoughts. But often how we live shows that that might be the case, that we have a small view of God. We will insist on keeping control of parts of our lives that matter to us instead of giving them over to God and trusting him with them. And it's only when we see God for who he is will we truly trust in his sovereign will. God is good, he's just, he's compassionate, he's gracious, he's wise, he's loving. His will for your life is all you need. His will is sufficient. And when we see how big God is, as Moses did, we will willingly submit because we will truly believe that this God really knows what to do with my life. And because God is sovereign and worthy of our trust, our second application here, as Moses was, we can be obedient in his task planned for us. See, Moses' role was quite straightforward in some ways. In verse 2, he said, you're to say everything I have commanded you. Simple as that. Just say everything I've told you to say. Leave the rest to me. Moses wasn't tasked with changing Pharaoh's heart. He was simply tasked with doing what God had told him to do. Aaron wasn't told to turn his staff into a snake. He was told to throw it on the ground. God did the rest. And sometimes when we think about what we've been commanded to do, we think about what the end result should be, and we get a little bit freaked by the magnitude of the task. The outcome is God's business. We are simply called to be obedient in our task of being God's spokespeople here on earth. In the New Testament, it says, "Be ready to give an answer for the hope that is within you." It doesn't say, "Make sure you persuade your family and friends that Jesus is the Son of God." The response to the message that we proclaim is between that person and God. We can do nothing about that. And we mustn't start claiming that we're not the right person for the job. Doesn't God delight in using exactly people like that to do his work? Moses, the stammering old man. Gideon, the least of the least. Peter, that simple fisherman. No, see, there are no caveats to obedience in mission. No one is excluded. We are all called to be God's mouthpiece. At work, at home, at the school gate, in your neighborhood. Be like Moses and Aaron. Do just as the Lord commanded you. That's what we're called to do. Live obedient lives. But maybe this morning you actually see more of yourself in Pharaoh than in Moses. Maybe this morning you realize that your heart is hard and that you've been resisting God. Maybe you've heard God speaking many times, even here at the village, but have yet to respond. Then look at me at the wonderful message of hope and salvation that is in this passage. And here you will find a God powerful to save. A God powerful to save. Look at verse 3. "Then I will lay my hand on Egypt, and with mighty acts of judgment I will bring out my divisions, my people, the Israelites." See, God's plan of salvation for the Israelites is brought about by these mighty acts of judgment. The way of salvation for the Israelites is through the plagues that will come upon the Egyptians. And even for the Egyptians at this time, salvation was available as they saw God working in their land, as they saw their deities defeated one by one by one. And in the coming weeks, you will see that some of the Egyptians did respond and believe about what God was going to do in their land. You see, God is sovereign in judgment, and he's sovereign in salvation. And nowhere is that seen more than on the cross of Jesus Christ. When Jesus cried out on the cross, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The ultimate act of salvation was made possible through a mighty act of judgment. The wrath of God was poured out on Jesus Christ so that we, hard-hearted sinners, may know salvation and may know forgiveness. Death was defeated. Sin was overcome. Grab your Bibles. Turn to Genesis chapter 3. So on page 5, look at verse 15. This is the account of the conversation between God and the devil in the immediate aftermath of the fall. The devil, of course, being there in the person of a snake. Verse 15, "And I will put enmity between you and the woman, and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head, and you will strike his heel." Way back at the very beginning, God promised the devil in his disguise as a serpent that his head one day would be crushed by a human. At the cross, that prophecy came true. Just in the way as Pharaoh's snakes were destroyed, Jesus came to be the ultimate snake crusher. Death and sin were no more. My friend, as was Pharaoh, each one of us is responsible for the hardness of our heart. We may see God act over and over again. We may not see staffs being turned into snakes and witness the mother of all snake fights, but that wasn't even enough for Pharaoh. We are given each new day, though. We do see the wonderful creation around us. We have his word, which declares his mighty works, most of all that work on the cross. Now, to be part of God's salvation plan, you simply have to respond by acknowledging who God is. Accept that he is the Lord of your life. He is worthy of your praise and your worship. He alone can rescue you from the hardness of your sinful heart. And he alone can lead you into the promised land, eternity in heaven. He alone is all you need. Who, O Lord, could save themselves? Their own soul could heal. Our shame was deeper than the sea. Your grace is deeper still. And you alone can rescue. You alone can save. You alone can lift us from the grave. You came down to find us, led us out of death. To you alone belongs the highest praise. Let's stand to sing as the music starts.